This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Lacuna, written and performed by Barbara Kingsolver. Copyright 2009 by Barbara Kingsolver. Production copyright 2009 by HarperCollins Publishers. A note on historical references. All articles and excerpts from the New York Times used in this text appear as originally published, reprinted with permission. April 15, 1939. Rivera still admires Trotsky, regrets their views clashed. By Diego Rivera. August 25, 1940. U.S. forbids entry of Trotsky's body. Soviet calls him traitor. Special to the New York Times. December 13, 1941. 2,541 Axis aliens now in custody. Special to the New York Times. October 23, 1947. 79 in Hollywood found subversive, inquiry head says. By Samuel A. Tower. Special to the New York Times. September 26, 1948. Truman is linked by Scott to Reds. Special to the New York Times. The following article excerpts are also used with permission. Life, July 17, 1944. Japanese beetle, voracious, libidinous, prolific, he is eating his way across the U.S. By Anthony Standen. Life, September 19, 1949. Peekskill battle lines. The Wheeling Intelligencer, February 10, 1950. McCarthy charges Reds hold U.S. jobs. By Frank Desmond. All other newspaper articles in the novel are fictional. Historical persons are portrayed and quoted from the historical record, but their conversations with the character Harrison Shepard are entirely invented. This is a work of fiction. Part 1. Mexico, 1929 to 1931, signed with the initials VB. Isla Pichol, Mexico, 1929. In the beginning were the howlers. They always commenced their bellowing in the first hour of dawn, just as the hem of the sky began to whiten. It would start with just one. His forced, rhythmic groaning like a saw blade. That aroused others near him, nudging them to bawl along with his monstrous tune. Soon the maroon-throated howls would echo back from other trees farther down the beach until the whole jungle filled with roaring trees. As it was in the beginning, so it is every morning of the world. The boy and his mother believed it was saucer-eyed devils screaming in those trees, fighting over the territorial right to consume human flesh. The first year after moving to Mexico to stay at Enrique's house, they woke up terrified at every day's dawn to the howling. Sometimes she ran down the tiled hallway to her son's bedroom, appearing in the doorway with her hair loose, her feet like iced fish in the bed, pulling the crocheted bedspread tight as a web around the two of them, listening. It should have been like a storybook here. That is what she'd promised him back in the cold little bedroom in Virginia, North America. If they ran away to Mexico with Enrique, she could be the bride of a wealthy man, and her son would be the young squire, in a hacienda surrounded by pineapple fields. The island would be encircled with a shiny band of sea like a wedding ring, and somewhere on the mainland was its gem, the oil fields where Enrique made his fortune. But the storybook was The Prisoner of Zenda. He was not a young squire, and his mother, after many months, was still no bride. Enrique was their captor, surveying their terror with a cool eye while eating his breakfast. "That howling is the aullaros," he would say, as he pulled the white napkin out of its silver ring into his silver-ringed fingers, placing it on his lap and slicing into his breakfast with a fork and knife. "They howl at one another to settle out their territories before they begin a day of hunting for food." Their food might be us, mother and son agreed when they huddled together inside the spiderweb of bedspread, listening to a rising tide of toothsome roars. "You had better write all this in your notebook," she said, "the story of what happened to us in Mexico. So when nothing is left of us but bones, someone will know where we went." She said to start this way. "In the beginning were the aullaros, crying for our blood." Enrique had lived his whole life in that hacienda, ever since his father built it and flogged the indios into planting his pineapple fields. He had been raised to understand the usefulness of fear. So it was nearly a year before he told them the truth. The howling is only monkeys. He didn't even look across the table when he said it, only at the important eggs on his plate. He hid a scornful smile under his mustache, which is not a good hiding place. "Every ignorant Indian in the village knows what they are. You would, too, if you went out in the morning instead of hiding in bed like a pair of sloths." It was true. The creatures were long-tailed monkeys, eating leaves. How could such a howling come from a thing so honestly ordinary? But it did. The boy crept outdoors early and learned to spot them high in the veil of branches against white sky. Hunched, woolly bodies balanced on swaying limbs, their tails reaching out to stroke the branches like guitar strings. Sometimes the mother monkeys cradled little babes, born to precarious altitudes, clinging for their lives. So there weren't any tree demons. And Enrique was not really a wicked king. He was only a man. He looked like the tiny man on top of a wedding cake, the same round head with parted shiny hair, the same small mustache. But the boy's mother was not the tiny bride, and of course there is no place on that cake for a child. When Enrique wanted to ridicule him after that, he didn't even need to mention devils. He only rolled his eyes up at the trees. "The devil here is a boy with too much imagination," he usually said. That was like a mathematics problem. It gave the boy a headache because he couldn't work out which was the wrong part of the equation, being a boy or being imaginative. Enrique felt a successful man needed no imagination at all. Here is another way to begin the story. And this one is also true. The rule of fishes is the same as the rule of people. If the shark comes, they will all escape and leave you to be eaten. They share a single jumpy heart that drives them to move all together, running away from danger just before it arrives. Somehow they know. Underneath the ocean is a world without people. The sea roof rocks overhead as you drift among the purple trees of the coral forest, surrounded by a heavenly body of light made of shining fishes. The sun comes down through the water like flaming arrows, touching the scaly bodies and setting every fin to flame. 1,000 fishes make the school, but they always move together, one great, bright, brittle altogetherness. It's a perfect world down there, except for the one of them who can't breathe water. He holds his nose, dangling from the silver ceiling like a great ugly puppet. Little hairs cover his arms like grass. He is pale, lit up by watery light on prickled boy skin, not the scaled, slick silver merman he wants to be. The fish dart all around him, and he feels lonely. He knows it is stupid to feel lonely because he isn't a fish, but he does. And yet he stays there anyway, trapped in the below life, wishing he could dwell in their city with that bright liquid life flowing all around him. The glittering school pulls in at one side and pushes out the other, a crowd of specks moving in and out like one great breathing creature. When a shadow comes along, the mass of fish darts instantly to its own center, imploding into a dense, safe core and leaving the boy outside. How can they know to save themselves and leave him to be eaten? They have their own god, a puppet master who rules their one fish mind, holding a thread attached to every heart in their crowded world. All the hearts but one. The boy discovered the world of the fishes after Leandro gave him a diving goggle. Leandro, the cook, took pity on the fluty boy from America who had nothing to do all day but poke around in the cliffs along the beach, pretending to hunt for something. The goggle had glass lenses and was made with gum rubber and most of the parts of an airman's goggle. Leandro said his brother used it when he was alive. He showed how to spit in it before putting it on, so it wouldn't go foggy. "Andale, go on now. Get in the water," he said. "You will be surprised." The pale-skinned boy stood shivering in water up to his waist, thinking these were the most awful words in any language. "You will be surprised." The moment when everything is about to change. When mother was leaving father, loudly, glasses crashing against the wall. Taking the child to Mexico, and nothing to do but stand in the corridor of the cold little house waiting to be told. The exchanges were never good. Taking a train, a father and then no father. Don Enrique from the consulate in Washington, then Enrique in mother's bedroom. Everything changes now, while you stand shivering in the corridor waiting to slip from one world into the next. And now, at the end of everything, this, standing waist-deep in the ocean wearing the diving goggle, with Leandro watching. A pack of village boys had come along, too, their dark arms swinging, carrying the long knives they used for collecting oysters. White sand caked the sides of their feet like pale moccasins. They stopped to watch, all the swinging arms stopped, frozen in place, waiting. There was nothing left for him to do but take a breath and dive into that blue place. And, oh God, there it was, the promise delivered, a world. Fishes mad with color, striped and dotted, golden bodies, blue heads, societies of fish, a public, suspended in its watery world, poking pointed noses into coral. They pecked at the pair of hairy tree trunks, his legs, these edifices that were nothing to them but more landscape. The boy got a bit of a stiffy. He was that afraid and that happy. No more empty-headed bobbing in the sea after this. No more believing in an ocean with nothing inside but blue water. He refused to come out of the sea all day until the colors began to go dark. Luckily, his mother and Enrique had enough to drink, sitting on the terrace with the men from America, turning the air blue with their cigars, discussing the assassination of Obregón, wondering who would now stop the land reforms before the Indios took everything. If not for so much mezcal and lime, his mother might have grown bored with the man talk and thought to wonder whether her son had drowned. It was only Leandro who wondered. The next morning, when the boy walked out to the kitchen pavilion to watch breakfast cooking, Leandro said, "Pícaro, you'll pay. A man has to pay for every crime." Leandro had worried all afternoon that the goggle he brought to this house had become an instrument of death. The punishment was waking up with a sun-broiled spot the size of a tortilla, hot as fire. When the criminal pulled up his nightshirt to show the seared skin on his back, Leandro laughed. He was brown as coconuts and hadn't thought of sunburn. But for once, he didn't say, "Usted pagará," in the formal language of servants to masters. He said, "Tú pagarás," you will pay, in the language of friends. The criminal was unrepentant. "You gave me the goggle, so it's your fault," and went back into the sea again for most of that day and burnt his back as crisp as fat rinds in a kettle. Leandro had to rub lard on it that night, saying, "Pícaro, rascal boy, why do you do such stupid things?" "No seas malo," he said, "the familiar you," language of friends, or lovers, or adults to children. There is no knowing which. On Saturday night before Holy Week, Salome wanted to go into town to hear the music. Her son would have to go too, as she needed an elbow to hang upon while walking around the square. She preferred to call him by his middle name, William, or just Will, conditioned as that is on future events, "You will." Though on her tongue, of course, it sounded like wheel, a thing that serves, but only when in motion. Salome Huerta was her name. She had run away at a young age to become an American Sally, and then Sally Shepherd for a while. But nothing ever lasted long. American Sally was finished. This was the year of Salome pouting, her last one in the hacienda on Isla Pichol, though no one knew it yet. That day she had pouted because Enrique had no intention of walking around with her on the Zocalo just to show off a frock. He had too much work to do. Work meant sitting in his library, running both hands through his slick hair, drinking mezcal, and sweating through his collar while working out colonnades of numbers. By this means he learned whether he had money up to his mustache this week or only up to his bollocks. Salome put on the new frock, painted a bow on her mouth, took her son by the arm, and walked to town. They smelled the Zocalo first. Roasted vanilla beans, coconut milk candies, boiled coffee. The square was packed with couples walking entwined, their arms snaking around one another like the vines that strangle tree trunks. The girls wore striped wool skirts, lace blouses, and their narrow-waisted boyfriends. The mood of the fiesta was enclosed in a perfect square. Four long lines of electric bulbs strung from posts at the corners, fencing out a bright piece of night just above everyone's heads. Lit from below, the hotel and other buildings around the square had eyebrow-shaped shadows above their iron balconies. The little cathedral looked taller than it was, and menacing, like a person who comes into the bedroom carrying a candle. The musicians stood in the little round belvedere whose pointed roof and wrought iron railings were all freshly painted white, along with everything else, including the giant old fig trees around the square. Their trunks blazed in the darkness, but only up to a certain point, as if a recent flood of whitewash through town had left a high water mark. Salome seemed happy to float with the moving river of people around the square, even though, in her elegant lizard-skin shoes and flapper crepe that showed her legs, she looked like no other person there. The crowd parted for her. Probably it pleased her to be the green-eyed Spaniard among the Indians, or rather the criolla, Mexican-born but pure nonetheless, with no Indian blood mixed in. Her blue-eyed, half-American son was less pleased with his position, a tall weed growing among the broad-faced townspeople. They would have made a good illustration for a book showing the castes of the nation, as the school books did in those days. "Next year," Salome said in English, pinching his elbow with her fierce crab claws of love, "you'll be here with your own girl. This is the last Noche Palmas you'll want to walk around here with your old wrinkle." She liked using American slang, especially in crowds. "This is posalutely the berries," she would announce, putting the two of them inside an invisible room with her words, and closing the door. "I won't have a girlfriend." "You'll turn 14 next year. You're already taller than President Portes Gil. Why wouldn't you have a girlfriend?" "Portes Gil isn't even a real president. He only got in because Obregón was iced." "And maybe you will likewise ascend to power after some girl's first novio gets the sack. Doesn't matter how you get the job, ducky. She'll still be yours." "Next year, Mother, you could have this whole town if you want it." "But you'll have a girl. This is all I'm saying. You'll go off and leave me alone." It was a game she played, very hard to win. "Or, if you don't like it here, Mother, you could go somewhere else. Some smart city where people have better entertainments than walking in circles around the Zócalo." "And," she persisted, "you'd still have the girl." "Not just a girl, but the girl, already an enemy." "What do you care? You have Enrique." "You make him sound like a case of the pox." In front of the wrought iron bandstand, the crowd had cleared a space for dancing. Old men in sandals held stiff arms around their barrel-shaped wives. "Next year, Mother, no matter what, you won't be old." She rested her head against his shoulder as they walked. He had won. Salome hated that her son was now taller than she was. The first time she noticed, she was furious, then morose. In her formula of life, this meant she was 2/3 dead. The first part of life is childhood. The second is your child's childhood, and then the third, old age. Another mathematics problem with no practical solution, especially for the child. Growing backward, becoming unborn, that would have been just the thing. They stopped to watch the mariachis on the platform, handsome men with puckered lips giving long kisses to their brass horns. Trails of silver buttons led down the sides of their tight black trousers. The Zócalo was jammed now. Men and women kept arriving from the pineapple fields with the day's dust still on their feet, shuffling out of the darkness into the square of electric light. In front of the flat stone breast of the church, some of them settled in little encampments on the bare earth, spreading blankets where a mother and father could sit with their backs against the cool stones while babies slept rolled in a pile. These were the vendors who walked here for Holy Week, each woman wearing the particular dress of her village. The ones from the south wore strange skirts like heavy blankets wrapped in pleats and delicate blouses of ribbon and embroidery. They wore these tonight and on Easter and every other day, whether attending a marriage or feeding pigs. They had come here carrying bundles of palm leaves and now sat untying them, pulling apart the fronds. All night their hands would move in darkness to weave the straps of leaf into unexpected shapes of resurrection. Crosses, garlands of lilies, doves of the Holy Spirit, even Christ himself. These things had to be made by hand in one night for the forbidden Palm Sunday Mass and burned afterward because icons were illegal. Priests were illegal. Saying the Mass was illegal. All banned by the revolution. Earlier in the year, the Cristeros had ridden into town wearing bullets strapped in rows like jewelry across their chests, galloping around the square to protest the law banning priests. The girls cheered and threw flowers as if Pancho Villa himself had risen from the grave and located his horse. Old women rocked on their knees, eyes closed, hugging their crosses and kissing them like babies. Tomorrow, these villagers would carry their secret icons into the church without any priest and light the candles themselves, moving together in single-minded grace. Like the school of the fish, so driven to righteousness they could flout the law, declare the safety of their souls, then go home and destroy the evidence. It was late now. The married couples had begun to surrender dancing space to a younger group. Girls with red yarn braided into their hair and wound around their heads into thick crowns. Their white dresses swirled like froth, with skirts so wide they could take the hems in their fingertips and raise them up to make sudden wings, like butterflies, fluttering as they turned. The men's high-heeled boots cut hard at the ground, drumming like penned stallions. When the music paused, they leaned across their partners in the manner of animals preparing to mate. Move away, come back. The girls waggled their shoulders. The men put handkerchiefs under their arms, then waved them beneath the girls' chins. Salome decided she wanted to go home immediately. "We would have to walk, Mother. Natividad won't come for us until 11, because that's what you told him." "Then we'll walk," she said. "Just wait another half hour. Otherwise we'll be walking in the dark. Bandits might murder us." "Nobody will murder us. The bandits are all in the Zocalo trying to steal purses." Salome was practical, even as a hysteric. "But Mother, you hate to walk." "What I hate is watching these primitives showing off. A she-goat in a dress is still a she-goat." Darkness fell down on everything then, like a curtain. Someone must have shut off the lights. The crowd breathed out. The butterfly girls had set glasses with lighted candles onto their braid-crowned heads. As they danced, their candles floated across an invisible surface like reflections of the moon across a lake. Salome was so determined to walk home, she had already started in the wrong direction. It wasn't easy to overtake her. "Indian girls," she spat. "What kind of man would chase after that? A corn eater will never be any more than she is." The dancers were butterflies. From 100 paces, Salome could see the dirt under these girls' fingernails, but not their wings. Enrique was confident the oil men would come to an agreement, but it could take some time. The oil men had come to Isla Pichol with their wives. They all took rooms in town. Enrique tried to persuade them to stay at the hacienda, since the advantages of his hospitality might work in his favor in the negotiations. "That hotel was built before the flood of Noah. Have you seen the elevator? A birdcage hanging from a watch chain. And the rooms are smaller than a cigar tin." Salome shot her eyes at him. How would he know that? The wives wore bobbed hair and smart frocks, but all had entered the third of what Salome called the three portions of life. Possibly they'd entered the fourth. After dinner, while the men smoked Tuxtlan cigars in the library, the women stood outside in point-heeled shoes on the tiled terrace, with their little hats pinned against the wind and cheek curls plastered down. Holding glasses of vino tinto, they gazed across the bay, speculating about the silence under the sea. "Seaweed swaying like palm trees," they all agreed, "quiet as the grave." The boy, who sat on the low wall at the edge of the terraza, thought, "These budgies would be disappointed to know it's noisy as anything down there. Strange, but not quiet. Like one of the mysterious worlds in Jules Verne's books, filled with its own kinds of things, paying no attention to ours. Often he shook the bubbles from his ears and just listened, drifting along, attending the infinite chorus of tiny clicks and squeaks, watching one fish at a time as it poked its own way around the coral. He could see it was talking to the others, or at any rate, making noises at them. "What is the difference," he asked Leandro the next day, "between talking and making a noise?" Salome hadn't yet learned Leandro's name. She called him the new kitchen boy. The last Galopina was a pretty girl, Ophelia, too much admired by Enrique, given the sack by Salome. Leandro took up more space, standing with bare feet set apart, steady as the stuccoed pillars supporting the tile roofs above the walkways of this yellow ochre house. A row of lime trees in large terracotta pots lined the breezeway between the house and kitchen pavilion. And like a tree, Leandro was planted there for most of each day, cutting up chayotes with his machete on the big work table, or peeling shrimps, or making sopa de milpa, corn kernel soup with diced squash blossom and avocado, xochitl soup with chicken and vegetables in broth, salads of cactus nopales with avocado and cilantro. The rice he made with a hint of something sweet in it. Every day, he said, "You could pick up that knife and stop being a nuisance," but smiling, not the way Salome said nuisance, not the way she said, "If you come in here with those sandy feet, your name is mud." Regarding the difference between talk and noise, Leandro said, "Ça depende." Depends on what? On intention. Whether he wants another fish to understand his meaning. Leandro considered his pile of shrimps solemnly, as if they might have had a last wish prior to execution. If the fish only wants to show he is there, it's a noise. But maybe the fish clicks are saying, "Go away," or "My food, not yours." Or "Your name is mud." Leandro laughed, because in Spanish it sounds funny. Su nombre es Lodo. Exacto, Leandro said. Then to another fish, it's talk, the boy said. But to me, it's only noise. Leandro needed help. Too many mouths to feed in this house. The Americans liked to eat. Also, it was Salome's birthday, and she wanted squid. The oilmen's wives' eyes would swing like the pendulum of a clock beneath their cloche hats when they saw squid a la Veracruzana. But the men would eat tentacles without noticing, enthralled with their own stories. How their hired guns had put down the rebellion in Sonora and sent Escobar running like a dog. The more mezcal went into their glasses, the faster Escobar ran. After supper, Leandro said, "El flojo trabaja doble," the lazy man has to work double, because the boy tried to carry all the dishes to the kitchen at once. He dropped two white plates on the tile, shattering them all to buttons. So Leandro was right. Sweeping up took twice as long as making an extra trip. But Leandro came out and helped pick up the mess, kneeling beneath the Americans' gaze as they commiserated on the clumsiness of servants. Here is one thing that's the same in every country. Afterward, Salome tried to get them all to cut a rug. She cranked up the Victrola and waved the mezcal bottle at the men, but they went to bed, leaving her fluttering around the parlor like a balloon of air let go. It was her birthday, and not even her son to whom she had given life would cut a rug with her. "For God's sake, William, you're tedious," she diagnosed. "Nose in the books, you're nothing but a canceled stamp. Flutie, green apples, wet blanket, this is only a small sample of the names that came to mind when Salome was stewed to the hat." He did try to dance with her after that, but it was too late. She couldn't hold herself up on her own stilts. Salome is airtight, the men like to say. Copacetic, the cat's meow, a snake charmer. also a fire bell. One of the oil men said that to his wife when the others were outside, explaining the situation. Fire bell meant still married to the husband in America. After all this time not divorced, some poor sod in D.C., an administration accountant. She had the affair right under his nose with this Mexican attaché. She couldn't have been more than 25 at the time, and with that child already. Left the other fellow flat. "Be careful of this fancy Salome," he warned his wife. "She's a disappearing act." On Cinco de Mayo, the village celebrated with fireworks, commemorating the victory over Napoleon's invasion in the battle at Puebla. Salome had a headache, one last gift from the night before, and spent the day in her little bedchamber at the end of the hall. She called it Elba, her place of exile. Lately, Enrique had been retiring early and closing the heavy door to his own bedroom. Today she was in no mood for noise. Today, she complained, they were making more explosions in the campo than it probably took to scare off Napoleon's army in the first place. The boy did not walk into town for the celebration. He knew that in the long run, Napoleon's generals still came back and cuffed Santa Anna and took over Mexico long enough to make everyone speak French and wear tight pants until 1867 or something near it. He was supposed to finish the book on Emperor Maximiliano from Enrique's library. That was Salome's program for him, reading moldy books. Because there was no school in Isla Pichol suitable for a boy who was already taller than President Portes Gil. But the best place for reading was in the forest, not the house. Under a tree by the estuary, 20 minutes walk down the trail. And the book on Maximiliano was enormous, so it only made sense to carry The Mysterious Affair at Stiles instead. The biggest amate tree had buttresses like sails reaching out from the trunk, dividing out little rooms furnished with drapes of fern and patchouli, a rooming house for dragonflies and ant thrushes, and once a coiled little snake. Many trees in that jungle were as broad around their bases as the huts in Leandro's village and held their branches too high to see. There was no knowing what lived up there. Once the saucer-eyed devils had howled for blood, but maybe those branches were only the balconies of monkey hotels and nesting places for oropendola birds, whose gurgling song sounded like water bubbling out of a tin canteen. In Enrique's library, every wall was covered with wooden cabinets. The room had no windows, only shelves, and all the book cabinets had iron grills covering their fronts like prisoners' windows, locked over shelves packed with books. The square openings between the welded bars were just large enough for a fine-boned, long-fingered boy to put his hand through, like slipping on an iron bracelet. He could reach in and touch the book's spines, exactly as Count Dantes in The Count of Monte Cristo had reached through the bars to touch his bride's face when she came to see him in prison. Carefully he could slide one book from its place in the packed shelf, and with both hands put through the bars he could turn and examine it, sometimes even open it, if the shelf were deep enough, but not remove it. The grills had iron padlocks. Every Sunday, Enrique brought out the skeleton key, unlocked the case, and took out 4 books exactly, which he left in a pile on the table without discussion. Invariably historical, stinking of mold, these were to be a boy's education. A few were all right, Zozobra, and also Romancero Gitano, poems by a young man who loved gypsies. Cervantes held promise, but had to be puzzled out in some ancient kind of Spanish. one week only with Don Quixote, before turning him in to be locked up again and exchanged for a new week's pile, had felt like a peek through a keyhole. And anyhow, not a single one of those books could hold 8 minutes to Agatha Christie or the others he'd brought from before when they came here on the train. His mother had let him carry 2 valises, one for books, one for clothes. The clothes were a waste, outgrown instantly. He should have filled both with books. The Mysterious Affair at Styles, The Count of Monte Cristo, Around the World in 80 Days, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, books in English that didn't stink of mold. He'd already read most of them now, more than once. The 3 Musketeers still called out to him, waving their swords, but he always shoved them back in the valise. Because what would be left when all these books were in the past? He lay awake nights dreading it. The program of a real school was vague in Salome's convictions, and frankly in his own, dank memories of wool coats and rough boys, and sport, a terrible thing, daily enforced. One lady in a brown sweater used to give him books to keep. That was the best thing he recalled from home. But that is not what we call home now, Salome said. We're here, and there isn't a school, so you'll just have to read every book in that damned library if we're allowed to stay. If not, her program became less certain. The library often stank from the oil men in there smoking Tuxtlan cigars all night. Salome hated all of it. Cigars, men talking, also locked up books, or any other kind, it seemed, and fluty boys who read them too much. But even so, she bought him a notebook from the shop by the ferry docks on the day they'd tried to run away from Enrique and cried because of having absolutely nowhere to go. She sat limp on the iron bench in her silk crepe dress, shoulders shaking. For such a long time, he'd had to wander over to the window of the tobacco stand and leaf through magazines. There he'd found the pasteboard notebook, the most beautiful book ever. It could become anything. She came up behind him while he was looking at it, set her chin on top of his shoulder, wiped her cheek with the back of a hand, and said, "We'll take it then." The man wrapped it carefully in brown paper, tied with a string. That was the story she had wanted him to begin, to tell what happened in Mexico before the howlers swallowed them down without a trace. Later on, many times, she would change her mind and tell him to stop writing. It made her nervous. At the end of that day, after running away, buying a notebook, and eating boiled shrimps from a paper cone while standing on the pier watching ferries leave, they'd gone back to Enrique, of course. They were prisoners on an island, like the Count of Monte Cristo. The hacienda had heavy doors and thick walls that stayed cool all day, and windows that let in the sound of the sea all night. Hush, hush, like a heartbeat. He would grow thin as bones here, and when the books were all finished, he would starve. But no, now he would not. The notebook from the tobacco stand was the beginning of hope, a prisoner's plan for escape. Its empty pages would be the book of everything, miraculous and unending like the sea at night, a heartbeat that never stops. Salome, for her part, was not worried about running out of books, only of having her clothes go out of fashion. "You can't buy a thing on this island unless he wants me to be a she-goat, wear skirts down to the ground." A trunk with her nicest things had been mailed overland from Washington, D.C., last year, according to the lawyer who was supposed to be taking care of these matters. But both the trunk and the divorce seemed to have lost their way. Enrique said they might see that trunk one day, ojalá, if the Lord is willing. Meaning, if the Lord is not, the Zapatistas held up the train and took everything. The boy cried, "Oh, yes, imagine it! The Zapatistas in their gun belts, reading Miss Agatha Christie by the campfire, eating off Mother's Limoges and wearing her dressing gowns." Enrique pinched his mustache and said, "Imagine it! Too bad you can't sell daydreams like that for money." "Revolution in Mexico is a fashion," he announced to the oil men at supper on their last night. "Like the silly hats worn by our wives. I don't care what they told you in Washington. This country will work hard for the foreign dollar." He raised his glass. "The heart of Mexico is like that of a loyal woman married forever to Porfirio Diaz." The deal was made. The oil men went away. The next morning, Enrique let Salome sit on his lap at breakfast and give him a kiss like a trumpet player. "A sign of progress," she declared, after he'd gone out to inspect a new packing house. "Did you hear him say that? Hats worn by our wives?" Her first project now was to get herself moved back into his bedroom. Her second one was to fire his maid. The boy's best plan on any day was to make himself scarce. Walk out the back through the kitchen, down a long lane of mulata trees with red skin peeling away from their trunks, exposing smooth black skin underneath. Cut across the sand trail through the pineapple field, over the low rock wall out to the sea, carrying a rucksack with a book and a packet of tortillas for lunch, the diving goggle, and a bathing costume. No one would see but Leandro, whose eyes following him down the sand trail could make him feel naked when he was not. Leandro, who came barefoot up the lane every morning, carrying the smoky smell of breakfast fires from his village, but wearing a clean shirt laundered by his wife. Salome said Leandro already had a wife, a child, and a baby. "As young as he is," she clucked, happy that someone had wrecked his life even faster than she had wrecked hers. If Leandro was already in the second portion of life, the part with children, it was going to be short. Out on the reef, the fish came every day for the scraps of tortilla the boy brought from the kitchen and tore into pieces, casting his bread upon the waters. One fish had a mouth like a parrot's beak and a fire-red belly and was always the first in line to come banging up for the day's handout. So really, it wasn't a friend. It was like the men who came to visit for the free eats and their eyes full of Salome in a V-neck satin dress. Salome formulated her plan of attack. "First," she instructed Leandro, "we make only Enrique's favorite foods every day, starting with breakfast, cinnamon-flavored coffee, tortillas warm from the griddle, pineapple with ham, and what she called divorced eggs, two of them crowded onto a plate, one with mild red salsa and one with spicy green." Salome maintained her own perspective on romance. The kitchen was connected to the house by the passageway of lime trees. It had low brick walls, planks for work counters, and was open all around to the sea air so smoke could escape from the firebox of the brick stove. Posts in the corners held up the roof, and the brick bread oven hunched in one corner. Natividad, the oldest servant, who was nearly blind, came out every dawn to sweep out the firebox and light it again, feeling his way to the flame, laying the sticks side by side, like tucking children to bed. When Leandro came, he would push the fire to the sides, keeping the heat away from the center of the heavy iron griddle. He mopped the griddle with a rag dipped in the lard jar so the tortillas wouldn't stick. Next to the lard jar, he kept a big bowl of sticky corn dough, pinching up balls of it and pressing them flat by hand. The heat made a necklace of black pearls on each white tortilla as it cooked. In the thick ones, the gorditas, he cut ridges as they cooked for holding the bean paste. But for empanadas, he made them thin, folding the tortilla over the filling and sliding it into a pan of hot grease. Most of all, Enrique cared for pan dulces, made with wheat flour dough, puffy and soft, with a grit of coarse sugar on top, filled with pineapple, sweet and tart from the oven's wood smoke. Many a cook had been fired by Enrique before this Leandro arrived from heaven. Pan dulce is no easy trick. The vanilla has to be from Papantla. The flour is ground in a stone metate. Not like masa for tortillas, corn soaked in lime water that's ground up coarse and wet. Any Mexican can do that, Leandro said. Dry flour for European bread is a different matter. It has to be ground so fine it comes up into the air in clouds. The hard part was mixing in the water, going too fast. Dumping water on the flour in a cold gush, causing a catastrophe of lumps. Dios mío, what have you done there? The boy's excuse? The bucket was too heavy. Flojo, you're as tall as I am. You can lift the bucket. The dough had to be thrown away, and everything started over. Leandro from heaven, angel of patience, paused to rinse his hands in the wash bucket and dry them on his white trousers. Let me show you how to do this. Begin with 2 kilos of the flour. Make a mountain on the counter. Into this mound with your fingers crumble the flakes of butter, the salt, and soda. Then pull it out like a ring of volcanic mountains around a crater. Pour a lake of cold water in the center. Little by little, pull the mountains into the lake, water and shore together into a marsh. Gradually, no islands. The paste swells until there are no mountains left and no lake, only a great blob of lava. There! Not just any Mexican can do that, muchacho. Leandro flopped the dough over gently on the counter until it was smooth, fluid, and solid at the same time. It would sleep overnight in a covered bowl. In the morning he would roll it flat, cut it with a machete into squares, spoon a dot of pineapple filling on each one, and fold it in a triangle, sprinkled with sugar grains soaked in vanilla. Now you know the secret for making the boss happy, Leandro said. Cooking in this house is like war. I am the capitán of bread, and you are my sargento mayor. If he throws out your mother, you might still have a job if you can make pan dulce and blandas. Which are the blandas? Ugh, sargento, you can't make this kind of mistake. Blandas are the big, soft ones he's crazy for. Tortillas big enough to wrap a baby in, soft as an angel's wings. Si, senor, the tall boy saluted. Big enough to wrap angels in, soft as a baby's crupper. Leandro laughed. Small angels, he said. Only baby ones. On the 21st of June, 1929, a giant iguana climbed up the mango by the patio, causing Salome to stand up from her lunch and scream. And on that day, the 3 years' silence ended, though the iguana had nothing to do with it. It was a declaration signed by the president, ending the 3-year ban on saying the mass. The war with the Cristeros ended. The church bells rang all day on Sunday, calling back the priests with their gold rings, land holdings, and sovereignty intact. Enrique took it as proof. Mexico falls on her knees at the altar, ready to return to the days of Porfirio Diaz. True Mexicans will always understand the virtues of humility, piety, and patriotism. And decent women, he added pointedly to Salome, quoting Diaz, only in her home, like a butterfly in a glass jar, can woman progress to her highest level of decency. He expected her to take herself and her son to town for the reconciliation mass. if he wants a butterfly, he should let me stay home in his damn glass jar," she fumed in the carriage on the way to church. Salome was all for the 3 years' silence. In her opinion, the mass could only be more tedious if they made you wear cotton stockings. She, too, had lived under the reign of Porfirio, ruled by a dark supremacy of nuns who showed no mercy to a businessman's cheeky daughter who came to school with her ankles showing. Salome had maneuvered a miraculous escape, like the Count of Monte Cristo, a study tour in America, where she enlisted a claims accountant in her father's firm who was helpless before her charms. She'd solved the mathematical problem of age 16 by saying she was 20. At 24, she'd said the same thing again, balancing the equation. She became Sally, confirmed in the Church of Expediency. Even now, as they approached the cathedral in town, she rolled her eyes and said, "Opium of the masses," parroting the men in government who'd tried to rout the priests. But she didn't say it in Spanish for the driver to hear. The cathedral was packed with solemn children, farmers, and old women on tree-trunk legs. Some worked their way through the stations of the cross, orbiting around the crowd's periphery as deliberately as planets. A long line of townspeople waited to receive communion, but Salome walked to the head of the line, accepting the host on her tongue as if this were a bakery line and she had plenty of other errands. The priest wore gold brocades and a pointed hat. He had managed to keep his clothes very nice during his 3 years hiding out. All eyes followed him like plants facing light, except for those of Salome. She left as soon as possible and walked straight for the carriage, snapping at Natividad to get going, fiercely digging in her beaded bag for her aspirins. Everything about Salome came from a jar or a bottle. First, the powder and perfume, the pomade for her Marcel wave. Next, the headache from a bottle of mezcal. Then the cure from a bottle of Bellan's hot water relief. Maybe some other bottle gave her the flapper-dancing, crank-up-the-Victrola 23 Skidoo. Stashed under a table drape in her room, something to help her keep it up. If Enrique did not love her, she now announced in the carriage, it was not her fault. She didn't see how God was going to help any of this. Enrique's mother didn't approve of a divorcee, so that was one person to blame. And the servants, who did everything wrong. She would like to blame Leandro, but couldn't. The white flour dough he made for the pastries was perfect, as silky as Salome's white dress that could be poured out of a pitcher, in which she still hoped to be married one more time. The problem must be this long-legged son, bouncing with the bumps in the road, brushing hair out of his eyes, staring off at the ocean. No place on the top of the wedding cake for a boy already as tall as the president, who was not himself elected. To get to the oil fields in the Huasteca, Enrique had to take the ferry to shore, then the panga to Veracruz, then the train. If he had to be gone one day, he'd be gone a week, or better yet, a month. Salome wanted to go with him to Veracruz, but he said she would only want to buy things. Instead, he allowed them to come in the carriage to the pier in town to watch him leave on the ferry. In the flattering morning light, she waved her handkerchief from the dock, elbowing the sun to wave as well. They both had roles in the play called Enrique Makes Up His Mind. "Pretty soon he'll say the word, and we can let our hair down, kiddo. Then we'll think what to do about you." Enrique had mentioned a boarding school in the Distrito Federal. The pasteboard notebook was running out of pages, the book called What Happened to Us in Mexico. He asked to purchase a new one at the tobacco stand. But Salome said, "First, we'll have to see if there's more to the story." When the ferry was gone, they ate lunch on the malecón across from the shrimp jetty, watching seabirds wheel in circles, trying to steal food. Out on the water, men in small wooden boats pulled in their nets, crumpling up mounds of gray netting that rose like storm clouds from each hull. By late morning, the trawlers were already docked, with their rusted hulls all listing the same direction along the dock, double masts leaning like married couples, equally drunken. The air smelled of fish and salt. The palm trees waved their arms wildly in the sea wind, a gesture of desperation ignored by all. The boy said, "There is always more to the story. This lunch will be the next part." But Salome said what she always said now. "You need to stop doing that. Put the book away. It makes me nervous." On the way home, she directed the driver to stop at a little village near the lagoon. "Drop us off here and come back at 6, never mind for what," she said. The horse knew how to go everywhere, and it was a good thing, because old Natividad was nearly blind. That was a good thing also, as far as Salome was concerned. She wanted no witnesses. The village was too small even to have a market, only an immense stone head in the town square, left over from a century when the Indians had huge ambitions. Salome stepped down from the coach and strode past the great head with the beard of grass under its chin. At the end of the lane she said, "It's this way, come on," and turned up a path into the forest, walking fast in her sling-back shoes, her lips pursed, chin tilted down so the Marcel wave hung forward like a closed curtain. They came to a plank footbridge suspended on ropes over a ravine. Slipping off the pointed white shoes and dangling them from a hooked finger, she stepped out in her stockings onto the bridge over crashing water, then paused to look back. "Don't come," she said. "You should wait here." She was gone hours. He sat at the end of the plank bridge with his notebook on his lap. An enormous spider with a fire-red belly came along lifting one foot at a time, slowly pulling its entire body into a tiny hole in one of the planks. What a terrible thing to know! Every small hole could have something like that inside. A flock of parrots shuffled in the leaves. A toucan looked down its long nose, shrieking, "Ami! Ami!" Squatting by the chasm, he believed again in the tree devils, and so at dusk, howling, they arrived. When Salome returned, she took off her shoes again to cross the bridge, put them back on, and strode toward the village. Natividad was already waiting, a stone head himself, letting the horse graze. She climbed in the carriage and never spoke at all. It was a form of revenge to steal the pocket watch, something he could keep from his mother for refusing to tell why she'd gone into the jungle. He did it on the day the tailor rode out from town, eager for Salome's opinion about fabrics for Enrique's new suit. Enrique was away. It was only good manners for the tailor to take a glass of chinguirito with Salome, and then another one. There was plenty of time for a boy to creep into her room to look at the father box. It was covered with dust, shoved underneath the cabinet where she kept her toilet pot. She hated the man that much. "No use crying over a spilt father," she always said. Only once had she let him look at the things in this box, a photograph of a man who had been his father somehow. A bunch of old coins, fobs, jeweled cufflinks, and the pocket watch. He craved the watch. That first time, when she'd let him sit on the floor and touch everything in the box while she lay on her bed, propped on one elbow watching him, he'd dangled it on its chain in front of her eyes, making it swing like a hypnotist. "You are getting very sleepy." She said, "El tiempo cura y nos mata." Time cures you first, and then it kills you. Strictly speaking, these things are yours, she'd told him. But strictly speaking, they were not even hers. She'd scooped them up in a hurry without asking when she left and ran off to Mexico. In case we needed something to sell later on, if we fell on hard times. If they fell on something harder than Enrique, she must have meant. Now the watch she'd stolen was stolen again, a double cross. He'd crept in her room and taken it while she was in the parlor laughing at the tailor's jokes, lolling her head back on the silk sofa. Among all the treasures in the box, he'd only needed that one, the time that cures you first and later stops everything that's happening in your heart. The blue fog of Tuxtlan cigars came out of the library and filled the whole house. Two Americans had come back with Enrique this time to fumigate the southern shores of Mexico with their smoke and endless talk. The election campaign, Ortiz Rubio, that disaster Vasconcelos. Gringos always made Enrique nervous and Salome excited. She poured cognac in their glasses and let them see her chest when she leaned over. One looked, the other never did. Both were said to have wives. At midnight, they went out for a walk on the beach in their fedoras and leather shoes. Salome collapsed in a chair, all the flapper draining out of her. "You should go to bed," she announced. "I'm not a child. You should go to bed." "No bunk, mister. If he gets any more cross, we'll both be hoofing it out of here."
"Where would we go? Hoofs can't walk on water."
One of the men was Mr. Morrow, the ambassador, and the other was an oil man like Enrique. According to Salome, that second one was High Hattie, but she could make him produce the cash if she wanted to. "He's richer than God," she said. "Then he must have sunrise in his pocket and mercy in his shoes." She stared. "Is that from one of your books?"
"Not completely."
"What do you mean, not completely?" "I don't know. It sounds like it would be in Romancero Gitano, but it isn't."
Her eyes grew wide.
She had put her hair in a shellacked wave hours ago, but now it was coming apart, the short curls across her forehead coming loose from the rest. She looked like a girl who had just come in from playing.
"You made that up. Sunrise in his pocket and mercy in his shoes. It's a poem."
Her eyes clear as water, the points of her hair just touching her brows. The candlelight found long, narrow lines of satin in the cloth of her dress, a pattern that would never show up in ordinary daylight. He wondered how it would be to have a mother, really. A lovely, surprised woman like this, who looked at you at least once every day.
"You do need another book, don't you, to write down your poems?"
But already he was on the last page. The scene of his mother in the candlelight filled most of it, and the ending wasn't good. When the men came back, they cranked up the Victrola, and the one called "I Could Make Him Produce the Cash" tried to dance the Charleston with Salome. But his shoes had no mercy in them at all. You could tell they pinched his feet. Archivist's Note. These pages record the early life of Harrison William Shepherd, a citizen of the United States, born in 1916, Lychgate, Virginia, taken by his mother to Mexico at a young age. The words are those of H.W. Shepherd, vouchsafed, but the pages preceding are plainly not from the hand of a boy. He came to his powers early, that is well known, and many have remarked on it, but not so young as 13. He did acquire a notebook that year for making a journal, a habit kept on through life. The endeavor of it has passed unexpectedly from the author to myself, and all here collected. In January 1947, he began a memoir that was to be made of the early diaries.
The pages here previous came to me from his hand to be typed and filed as chapter one. I took it for a book's beginning. There was no call to doubt it, for he had written other books by then. He'd made what he could of that first pasteboard notebook mentioned, purchased on a dock in Isla Pichol, and probably disposed of it afterward. It was his habit, when he rewrote anything, to shed himself of all earlier versions. He kept a clean house. A few months afterward, he left off all intention of writing his memoir. Many were the reasons. One that he gave was, the next little notebook in the line had gone missing, his second boyhood diary, and he became discouraged of recalling what it contained. I believe he did remember a good deal of it, but I'll comment no further on it. He had concerns. There is a peculiar thing to tell about that second diary. He said he couldn't find it, and that was a fact. It only came to light in 1954. It turned up in a trunk of his things that had been stored many years in the home of an acquaintance in Mexico City. They found it after her death caused the household to be shuffled around. The diary is leather-bound, smaller than a sandwich, approximately 3 by 5 inches, easy to overlook. It was inside a trouser pocket, wrapped in a handkerchief. So it was never kept with all his later diaries, lying there lost a long while. He never did lay eyes on it again. It had no name inside it, only a date and heading on the first page, as will be shown. It was only by luck and a certain letter of instruction that the trunk was recognized as his and sent here to me. He was, of course, by that time gone. Without its surprising resurrection, that missing piece of the tale, there would be none to tell. Yet here it is. The writing is his for certain, the hand, style, and heading. He wrote similar things at the start of his notebooks, even when much older. The difference in style from the writer's memoir to the child's diary, the reader will shortly encounter. A man of 30 wrote the previous pages. A boy 14 wrote the diary herein to follow. All the diaries after it show the normal progress of age. In all, he showed a habit that claimed him for life, his manner of scarcely mentioning himself. Anyone else would say in a diary, "I had this kind of a supper," but to his mind, if supper lay on the table, it had reasons of its own. He wrote as if he'd been the one to carry the camera to each and every one of his life's events, and thus was unseen in all the pictures. Many were the reasons, again not mine to say. The little leather-bound booklet lost and found, then, was a diary he kept from 1929 until summer of 1930, when he left Isla Pichol. That one was a toil to transcribe, the nuisance being its size, small. He penciled it in the empty portions of a household accounts book. It was evidently a common type of booklet they had in the 1920s, stolen from a housekeeper, he plainly states. He hadn't yet the strong habit of putting a date to his entries. The third diary runs from June 1930 until November 12, 1931. He took more faith with dating the entries after enrolling in school. That one he kept in a hard-bound tablet of a type used by school children of the time, purchased in a Mexico City bookshop. The rest follow in order, many notebooks in all, an odd lot for shape and size, but all one gloss within. No man ever set a greater store in words, his own or others. I have taken pains to do the same. His penmanship was fair to good, and I was no stranger to his hand. I believe these texts to be loyal and stanch to his, apart from some small favors to a boy's spelling and grammars.
And small is the need for a boy that took his lessons from the mysterious affair at Stiles, and so forth. I took some reliable help with translating the Spanish, which he used now and again, probably without full understanding of the difference when young. He spoke both languages as a routine, English with the mother, Spanish with most others until his return to the United States. But sometimes he twixt the two, and I've had to guess on some. The common custom is to place a note such as this at a book's beginning. Instead, I let his own chapter 1 stand to the fore. He plainly meant it to be the start of a book. I stand behind the man, with ample reason in this instance. I had good years to learn the wisdom of it. My small explanations here are meant to introduce the remainder. I have set upon the whole of it certain headings for organizing purposes. These I marked with my initials. My only hope is to be of use. Signed with the initials V.B. Private Journal, Mexico, North America. Do not read this. El delito acusa. 2 November, Dead People's Day. Leandro is at the cemetery to put flowers on his dead people, his mother and father, grandmothers, a baby son that died when it was 1 minute old, and his brother who died last year. Leandro said, "It's wrong to say you don't have a family. Even if they are dead, you still have them." That isn't nice to think about. Ghost people standing in rows outside the windows, waiting to get acquainted. Leandro, wife, and dead people are having their party at the graveyard behind the rock beach on the other side. Tamales in banana leaves, atole, and pollo pipián. Leandro said those are the only foods that could attract his brother away from a lady. He meant Lady of the Dead, who is called Mictec something. Leandro couldn't spell it. He can't read. He didn't cook the tamales this time. At his house, the wife is captain of tortillas, and the sargentes are his nieces. When he leaves here, he goes home to a mud thatch house and women who cook for him. Maybe he sits in a chair and complains about us. No one comes to take off his boots. None to take off. All the maids went off also for Dia de los Muertos, and Mother had to warm the caldo for lunch herself. She complained about Mexican servants running off for every excuse. In Washington, D.C., who ever heard of the kitchen help having to go throw marigolds on a grave? She says the Indios have so many gods, they have an excuse to stilt out of work every day of the year. These Mexican girls! But Mother is one herself. A good thing to remind her, if you want a slap on the kisser. This morning she said, "I am no mestizo, mister, and don't you forget it." Don Enrique is proud of no Indios mixed up in his blood, pure Spanish only. So now Mother is proud of that too. But she has nothing to celebrate because of no Indian gods. Not even the god of pure Spaniards. She doesn't like him either. She said chingado when she burned her hand after the maids went to their party. Pinche, malinche. Mother is a museum of bad words. Don Enrique brought back the accounts book from a shop in Veracruz so we can keep track of the truth around here. He told Mother, "Desconfía de tu mejor amigo como de tu peor enemigo. Trust your loved ones as you trust your worst enemy. Write everything down." He slapped the little books on her dressing table, making her jump and the sleeves of her dressing gown tremble. He calls them truth books. Here is the truth. One booklet was pinched by the household thief. Mother was finished with it anyway. She started, but then Cruz took over the job of writing down which days Mother pays them. Otherwise, Mother says she paid, but really didn't, because she was juiced. Don Enrique told Cruz to keep tabs whilst he is away in the Huasteca. He says money runs out of this house like blood from a wound. 7 November. 72 seconds, longest time ever. If mother could hold her breath that long, she could be divorced. But that time does not really count. It is on land only. On a bed cercado de tierra, locked by land. Kneeling by the pillow, with a pinched nose, holding the watch up to the candle to see the seconds. It's harder to go that long in the water, because of cold. One way is to breathe a lot first, very fast, then take in one large breath and hold it. Leandro says, in the name of God, don't try that when you're diving. It's a good way to faint and drown. Leandro used to dive for lobster and sponge for his living before he was a cooking boy. That is some slide down the stairs, from a soldier's life out there diving to a galopino, cookie. That's as dangerous as sucking on a nurse's tit. It was a very rude thing to say this morning to Leandro, who isn't allowed to be angry. He came back from the Day of the Dead with his hair tied in a special way, the horsetail in back wound with henequen string. Probably his wife did that. Leandro said his brother, who made the diving goggle, was drowned last year whilst diving for sponge. He was 13, younger than you and already supporting his mother. Leandro said that without looking up, hitting the knife hard against the board, chopping onions. Natividad came in then with the tomatoes and epazote from the market, so there was no chance to say, no lo supe. Usually there is something terrible you don't know. Or for Leandro to say, you don't know anything. From the exciting life of diving, his brother got to be dead. That is the truth about soldiering, in case you want to know something, Leandro said. Cooking won't kill you. This morning, low tide was early. The village boys collecting oysters came into the cove and said this beach belonged to them. They screamed, "Vete, Rubio! Go away, blonde boy! Scramble away like a crab over the coral rocks." The path by the lagoon makes a dark tunnel through mangrove trees to the other side of the point. The beach over there is only a thin strip of rocks and disappears when the tide comes up. This morning the tide was lowest ever. Knobs of the reef cropped out of the water like heads of sea animals watching. That side is too rocky for boats. No one goes there. No oyster boys to scream at a Rubio who is not Rubio, with hair as Mexican black as mother's. When they look, do they see anything at all? Floating on the sea is like flying. Looking down on the city of fishes, watching them do their shopping. Flying away como el pez volador, like a flying fish. The bottom falls, and in deep water you can soar, slipping away from the crowded coral head shallows to the quiet dark blue. Shadows of hunters move along the bottom. At the back of the cove on that side, a rock ledge rises up from the water. You can see that cliff from the ferry. It has long white stripes of guano, banners marking the roost holes where seabirds think they are hiding. At the base of that cliff, something lay under the water that can't be seen from a boat. A dark something, or really a dark nothing, a great deep hole in the rock. It was a cave, big enough to dive down and crawl into, or feel around the edges and go a little way inside. It was very deep, a water path tunneling into the rock, like the path through the mangroves. An unexpected visit from Mr. Produce the Cash. Mother was in a mood when he left. His fancy shoes must have pinched her also. She started a spat with Don Enrique. November 24. Today, the cave was gone. Saturday last, it was there. Searching the whole rock face below the cliff did not turn it up. Then the tide came higher and waves crashed too hard to keep looking. How could a tunnel open in the rock, then close again? The tide must have been much higher today and put it too far below the surface to find. Leandro says the tides are complicated and the rocks on that side are dangerous to stay over here in the shallow reef. He wasn't pleased to hear about the cave. He already knew about it. It is called something already, La Laguna. So, not a true discovery. Laguna? The lagoon? No, Lacuna. He said it means a different thing from lagoon. Not a cave exactly, but an opening, like a mouth that swallows things. He opened his mouth to show. It goes into the belly of the world. He says Isla Pichol is full of them. In ancient times, God made the rocks melt and flow like water. It wasn't God, it was volcanoes. Don Enrique has a book on them. Leandro said some of the holes are so deep they go to the center of the earth and you'll see the devil at the bottom. But some only go through the island to the other side. How can you know which is which? It doesn't matter, because either one can drown a boy who thinks he knows more than God because he reads books. Leandro was very angry. He said, stay away from that place, or God will show you who made those holes. The Tragic Tale of Señor Pez. Once there was a small yellow fish with a blue stripe down his back, Señor Pez by name, who lived in the reef. One unfortunate day he was caught by the bare hands of a monstrous boy, the god of land. Señor Pez wanted to eat the tortilla offered by the hands of God, and so the beggar earns his fate. He was carried to the house in a diving goggle and put in a brandy glass of seawater on the windowsill in the bedchamber of God. For 2 days, Señor Pez circled the glass with trembling fins, grieving for the sea. One night, Señor Pez wished himself dead. In the morning, his wish was granted. He was to be given a Christian burial under the mango at the end of the garden, but the plan was spoilt by the cleaning girl. The maid mother hired this time is named Cruz, which means cross, which she is most of the time. She came into the bedchamber of God to pick up the god's foul stockings whilst he was outside reading. She must have found the floating body and decided to throw him out. God returned to his room to find no corpse, no brandy glass, and Señor Pez gone to the garbage jar with the kitchen scraps for the pigs. Leandro said it was true. He saw Cruz throw it in there. Leandro helped dig through the scraps to find Señor Pez. The boy god had to hold his nose for the stink and felt stupid and fluty because he almost cried when they couldn't find it. 13 years old, crying for a dead fish. Not for that, really, but it's being buried in a slop of onion peels and slimy seeds of a calabaza. Our meals are made from the other parts of these rotten things. The food inside us must also rot in the same way, and nothing is truly good or stays here because every living thing goes to rot. A stupid reason for crying. But Leandro said, there now, no te preocupes, we know Señor Pez is in here somewhere. Then he had an idea that was very good. Why don't we dig a big hole in the garden and bury everything together? And they did. Together, the two friends made a noble burial, as in times of old for the Azteca kings, the slop bowl providing the departed Señor Pez with everything needed for his journey into the second world, and a little more. 25 December. The village wakes up in a hurry, whilst the son seems to struggle with the job as mother does. Last night was the party for Christmas Eve. Today she will sleep until noon, then wake up with one hand across her forehead, the frilled elbows of her dressing gown shuddering. Her voice like a Browning machine rifle sending the house girls running for her headache powders, and everyone else out of the house. On the road walking to the village for Christmas Mass, a lot of people passed by, nuggets of family in brown shells. A man leading his pregnant wife on a burro, like Joseph and Mary. Three long-legged girls in dresses straddling one gray mare, their legs hanging down like a giant insect. A peevish rooster that ought to have been in a better mood because, look here, my friend, at the roadside butcher stand, all your comrades hang upside down ready for roasting. Sausages also were slung over the line like stockings, and a whole white pig skin just hanging, as if the pig went off and left his overcoat. His wife, the sow, was alive, tied to a papaya tree in the yard with her piglets rooting all round. They could be free to run away, but don't, because of their mother chained on the spot. The little church in the village has no bell, only copal tree incense floating out the open windows to mix with the fish-rot smell of ocean. Leandro was there with his family, resting one hand on each of his children's heads like grapefruits. Later at the fiesta, he didn't ever say Feliz Navidad or Hello, friend, I come to your house every day. He only clapped together his small son's hands for the piñata strung from the fig tree. There were firecrackers for the holy babe snapping blue smoke in the road, and amongst all the nut-brown families, one invisible boy. January 1, 1930. First day of the year and decade. Every cabeza in the house is full of headache powders. Shattered glasses in twinkling pools on the terraza. No word is heard from the turkey that chased children from the yard all December. He greets the new year from the kitchen, a carcass of bones attended by his audience of flies. A fine day to go out looking for a tunnel to another world. Perhaps to meet the devil. Mother called out, "Cállate, malinche, Dios mío, don't slam the door!" Not even the usual warning about sharks. Let them have boy flesh if they want. Clear sky, empty beach, and the water like a cool pair of hands begging. Even the reef fishes didn't speak today. The lacuna was there again, a dark mouth in the rock. This time, the opening was deeper below the surface, but it was still possible to dive down and feel between the lips of rock into a gullet that broadened in darkness. It was the last day of the world then, time to swim inside, thinking of Leandro's dead brother, stroking through cold water, counting the pounding heartbeats, 30, 40, 45, one half of 90. Waiting that long before turning around, feeling the way back toward the entrance, swimming with aching lungs back to the light. Sun and air. Breathing. Alive, after all. The hand of the watch returned to the top for one more year of life stolen back. 5 January. Tomorrow is Feast of the Kings. Only here it will be the feast of Don Enrique's sisters and mother who came over on the ferry. Leandro has to cook for them all. Cruz and the others went to their villages for the fiesta, but mother is determined to have a feast for the guests, with or without servants. She pretends she and Don Enrique are married, and the señora is to be called abuela. The so-called grandmother, in her chic frock, lights a cigarette, crosses her legs, blows smoke out the window. Mother wants green and red chalupas and scrambled egg torta with sugar. Leandro would like to be with his family. He's put out with mother for making him stay, so he made fun of the señora. A scandal. But he knows he won't be caught. The Capitan and his sergente have a conspiracy. The Rosca de Reyes is hardest to make. The cake called Ring of the Kings, using white flour dough, the same as for baby's crupper tortillas. A blob of dough fit for a king, rolled out on the table, as long and fat as a sea slug. Como pene. Poking it and laughing, como bato. Leandro is normally much more pious. Wiener, jaker, pachango, thing of the king. Leandro had tears in his eyes and said mother would kill us. He crossed himself and prayed for both souls. He made the cake into a ring by putting the thing of the king in a circle and pressing the ends together. The token goes inside, a small clay baby Jesus that looks like a pig. Leandro said, really, it's not even Jesus. It's the boy god Piltzintecutli. He dies when the days grow dark in December, then rises again on February 2nd, which is Candlemas. The ancients were concerned with light and darkness. We are in the dark days now, he said. Whoever finds the token in the cake will have good luck when the light returns. All the rest of the year, the clay token sits in a jar in the cabinet waiting to go into this cake. Leandro took the little pig Jesus out of the jar and kissed it before putting it in the rosca. Round jellied fruits go on top, but he put a square piece where the token was inside, his secret way of marking it. Reach for that one, he said, when the dish of cake is passed around. Is it still lucky if you cheat instead of getting the token by chance? Mijo, Leandro said, your mother can't even remember the day she gave you birth. If an orphan boy is going to have any luck, he will have to make it himself. What kind of orphan has two living parents? You said everyone has family, even if they are ghosts. Or forget your cumpleaños. Leandro took the orphan's cheeks in his hands and kissed him on the mouth, and then spanked his crupper like a child, not a boy as tall as a man. A boy with terrible thoughts of kissing a man as a man. Leandro meant nothing by it. A beso for a child. Leandro went home after the feast. All servants have fled, leaving kitchen scraps, bad moods, and dust. What is the use of good luck in an empty house? 2 February, Candlemas. Leandro was gone 19 days, now back. He has to make 100 tamales for Candlemas without his sergente. It's better to hide in the amate tree all day reading. A book won't run off to its family any time at once. Leandro can't even read. Let him make tamales all day. Today begins a year of perfect luck, protected by Piltzintecutli, the clay pig Jesus. 13 February. Today the lacuna appeared a little below the surface. It's near the center of the cliff, below a knob where a hummock of grass grows out. It should be easy to find again, but best to look early, with the sun just up and the tide low. Inside the tunnel it was very cold and dark again, but a blue light showed up faintly, like a fogged window, farther back. It must be the other end. No devil back there, but a place to come up on the other side, a passage. But too far to swim, and too frightening. One day, Piltzintecutli will say, go ahead, lucky boy. Vete, Rubio, swim toward that light. Go find the other side of the world where you belong. The strangest thing, Mother believes in magic. She went back to the village of the giant stone head. After sending Natividad away with the carriage, she said, this time we both go. She took off her shoes again to cross the footbridge, then followed a path through the forest right around the edge of a lake. Yellow-winged hakanas flapped up from the water, and an alligator rested at the edge, covered with waterweed up to its bulging eyes. Then back into the jungle, under giant trees. "We were going to see a brujo," she finally said, "because someone has put a bad eye on us both, and that's why she can't get another baby. Probably it was Don Enrique's mother." The brujo's bamboo hut stood in a clearing inside a circle of stones. It might have been made 1,000 years ago. The door was a curtain of snail shells strung together that made a wooden tinkling sound when his hand pulled it aside. Inside was an altar covered with little clay figures and branches with leaves standing in jars and cockle shells of burning copal gum, the same incense as in the church. He said to take off our shirts, which Mother did immediately, down to her silk underthings. The brujo didn't look at her. His eyes went to the roof of the hut, and he began to sing. So he truly was a brujo, not just a man. He seemed as old as a person could be, and still living. His chant was quiet and fast. Echate, echate. He walked all around Mother first, swatting her body gently with a branch of leaves dipped in a jar of leaf water, shaking drops of it on her hair, breasts, and belly, then everything else, sun included. Then he blew smoke over her from the cockle shell of burning gum. With his knotted old hands, he held up a figure cut from thin paper, a small, cat-like, man-shaped thing, and burned it in the flame of a candle. Some of the carved figures on his altar looked like a man's thing, his organ, stone pachangos. When he finished, Mother paid him in coins. She didn't speak until after crossing the bridge back to the village. The square was deserted, except for the great stone head. Natividad hadn't come back. "Enrique can't be told about this," she said. "You know that, of course." "Does he want you to get a baby?" She straightened her dress and pulled at the back of her stocking. "Well, it would change things, wouldn't it?"